Need for that very lengthy introduction. Vietnam was such a profound experience for me that I sometimes have difficulty remembering I did other things with my life.
You may want to try to speak in louder like that. This is the mic here. This is really good.
How's that?
Yep.
I'll repeat myself. Vietnam was a profound experience for me, as it was for many of the men in my generation. So profound that sometimes I have a tendency to forget that I did other things with my life. And one of the things I've tried to do since then is come to grips with what did we accomplish in Vietnam. And that was put into perspective for me recently by a good friend who was talking to a French veteran of the First Indochina War. And this Frenchman told him, "You Americans seem so ashamed of what you did in Vietnam, and you shouldn't be, because you gave the Vietnamese people 20 years of freedom that they wouldn't have had otherwise." And I think that's a rather positive note on which to start this this small presentation of mine on the portrayal of the American soldier in Vietnam. Perhaps no minority of Americans in recent history has been the butt of so much derogatory stereotyping as the 2.5 million men and 7,000 women that served their country in Vietnam between 1965 and 1972, a period which has become known as the Vietnam era. Never have soldiers who deserve better gotten worse than they have from this TV series. Throughout these segments, the viewer is bombarded with testimonials to the motivation, dedication, courage, and fortitude of our communist enemy in Vietnam. When American soldiers are not on camera praising their enemy, they're shown burning villages, reminiscing about war crimes and the drug scene, or engaged in other pursuits, either fleshly or frivolous. In an earlier sequence in the program, an American POW, tells about how he cracked under torture in North Vietnam. He's followed immediately by a Vietnamese female agent, a Viet Cong female agent, who tells how she did not crack under torture. And this leads the viewer to believe that even the Viet Cong females had a greater amount of will than the very best of our soldiers. The real truth is, of course, that we never mastered torture to the same extent our Vietnamese enemies did. Another impression that the films give us is that the American soldiers fought principally old women, men, and our children, and old men, and were markedly unsuccessful even at that. The truth is that most of the fighting took place in jungle areas, and it was us that fought, usually outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and sometimes outgunned. And that when American war potential was brought against the enemy, it was done with the express purpose of saving American lives. And I think there are a number of you here today that wouldn't be here today if there hadn't been this preponderance of American firepower in Vietnam. But the fact is that most of the ordnance was expended in areas where nobody lived, and that commanders were constantly enjoined to try to reduce the numbers of civilian casualties. And because of this, one historian has estimated that the number of civilians killed in both Vietnams during the war there was about 28% of the total death rate, which is far behind that of World War II in Korea. In every war, commanders experience morale problems among their troops, and the Vietnam War was no exception. In Vietnamizing the War, some false connections are established in this regard. The narrator informs us that in 1970, anti-war sentiments were spreading, morale was in decline, unquote. By linking the anti-war movement with the apparent decline in morale among U.S. troops in the final years of the war, the narrator creates an impression that the decline was partially politically motivated. In fact, there were two major factors in this: boredom, as combat operations wound down, and this contributed to a large extent to increased drug use among the troops and racial tensions and other morale problems, and the widespread desire not to be the last person killed in the war. By 1970, almost everybody had come to the conclusion that we weren't in Vietnam to win, and nobody wanted to be the last person killed in that war. They pointed out in the film that near the end of one's combat tour, soldiers were very reluctant to go on operations. And I think this is a fact of human nature. This was observable even in the early years of our involvement there, and it was nothing that was new by 1970. To what degree the peace movement at home, anti-war rhetoric, and the generally biased picture that the press presented of the Vietnam War had on morale, it's very hard to determine. But in 1973, when disillusion over Vietnam was highest among the Vietnam veterans, only 15% were identified by a survey of that year as being political radicals. And the actual membership in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War at that time, which was the most active organization then, has been estimated at about 7,000 by an authority. And membership in such groups remains minuscule even today. The Vietnam Veterans of America Incorporated, which is probably the most active of the so-called radical groups today, has a membership of around 17,000 people out of a membership pool of 9 million men and women that served during the Vietnam era. And the radical views of the organization are held mostly by the people who are its leaders. Robert Mueller, I think you'll hear some more about him later in this film. Gunnar Lewy has pointed out that the crisis in military discipline of the 1970s was worldwide, not confined exclusively to Vietnam. Inevitably, this reflected the change that our society was going through. AWOL and desertion rates for the military services, for the Army in particular, peaked in 1971, and the monthly average in that year was 176 AWOLs per 1,000 and 73 desertions. Now, the fact that is that most soldiers go AWOL or desert for personal reasons, not because of political motivation or because they can't cope with the rigors of military life. So saying that the soldiers' anti-war views were motivated by political reasons is specious. The film also cites, as another indicator of declining morale in the latter years of the war, the practice of fragging. Fragging is a slang term that means simply to kill or maim your superiors, and this is usually done to eliminate unpopular or incompetent leaders or even personal scores. During 1969 and 1971, there were 730 such incidents reported in Vietnam, which resulted in 83 deaths. This includes 203 possible incidents, by the way. In about 52% of these cases, the intended victims were officers or non-commissioned officers. The fact is, although figures aren't available from our other wars, that this kind of thing goes on all the time. And the rates may have been somewhat higher than those reported. But what I'm going to do is take these rates, these figures, and turn them around on their users. And I'm going to say that considering that the American Army in Vietnam was one of the most heavily armed populations in the world, it says a lot for discipline that these rates weren't much higher. And the same thing applies to the context of racial tensions, of which the film makes an awful lot. Black Vietnam veteran Ralph Thomas in the film says, "The racial polarization was deeper there than I've ever seen." Now, we don't know where else he saw this. "I saw it everywhere I served in the Army, and especially overseas. In Germany in the late 1950s, in Vietnam in 1962, and later in Korea in 1972. And polarization is used here in a pejorative sense. But it's a fact of life. Another fact is that the closer soldiers got to combat, the less this polarization became a factor. Now, this is pointed out in the film, but it's pointed out in passing. The fact is that most of the racial incidents we had occurred among rear area or support type troops. And the overpowering impact of the film and narrative completely submerges this extremely important distinction. And where the film fails as documentary is, it doesn't explore why there were racial tensions in Vietnam. I'm not saying that there weren't. There were. One reason is the misperception among blacks that they were sharing a disproportionate number of the casualties. Now, this is a myth, and I think it was first publicly stated by Martin Luther King in 1967, and it still persists in some quarters even today. Figures released by the Department of Defense reveal that overall, blacks suffered 12.5%, or about 7,200 of the deaths in Vietnam, 5,700 of these through combat action, 1,500 through non-combat accidents, at a time when the percentage of blacks in the general population was 13.5%. 10.6% of the soldiers who served in Vietnam were black, but during the Vietnam era, fully one-third, or 34%, of the black men who enlisted in the services volunteered for combat duty. That's a function of society and not a military policy. Now, given the formula that we had one of the most heavily armed populations in the world in Vietnam at that time, I think the fact that the racial tensions we did have didn't get out of hand as they did in Korea in 1972 is a compliment to the state of discipline among the black and white American soldiers in Vietnam, and one has to question why the makers of this film didn't point this out. Drug abuse is another portion of the film that that comes in for some heavy treatment, and it's attributed to being a major factor in the declining morale of our troops in the early 1970s. We saw this morning one young man saying, for $10 you could get a vial of pure heroin, liquid opium, speed, acid, anything you wanted. Another reminisces that for a box of Tide, you could get a carton of pre-packed, pre-rolled marijuana cigarettes soaked in opium. Now, if this is true, it's possibly the first time in history that a laundry detergent itself was parlayed into a form of angel dust for dealing in the drug market. The narrator cynically refers to this as business, and the remarks of one soldier that drug abuse was not rampant in his unit are followed immediately by the narrator intoning the results of a 1971 study commissioned by Congress that indicated narcotics were eroding discipline in Vietnam. According to another survey cited but not otherwise identified, there were 30,000 American heroin addicts in Vietnam. Now, by July 1971, that would have meant that more than one of in 10 of our soldiers in Vietnam was a heroin addict. Gunter Louie, again, cites a 1971 Department of Defense-sponsored survey that indicated 28% of our troops in Vietnam at that time had used heroin, nothing about addiction. Another survey published in 1974 determined that of the more than 3 million veterans who had served in Southeast Asia, about 45,000, or perhaps 1.3%, had become addicted to heroin. A 1980 study found that 90% of these men had kicked their habit after returning home. And obviously, in TV land, you take the statistics that support your view. Furthermore, an Army study of confirmed drug users conducted during the final quarter of 1971 found that nearly 75% of the men sampled had used at least one illegal substance on at least a weekly basis prior to entry into the service, while 20% had used heroin before Vietnam. The study also found that most of the respondents reported initiation into heroin under non-combat conditions, and that when drug use was seen to imperil the lives of other men in combat units, the soldiers took it upon themselves to discipline the offender. The same researcher, and it's Lieutenant Colonel Larry Ingram, who right now is stationed at Walter Reed Institute of Research, writing a decade later, concluded that at the time of his 1971 survey, there was, quote, no evidence that heroin used by young, healthy soldiers for less than 1 year decreased the combat proficiency of the American Army in Vietnam. The issue of war crimes, the ugliest of all the issues to be brought up in this film series, is one that is never treated very seriously, or with which the film never comes to grips. In America Takes Charge, a large segment of the film is devoted exclusively to narratives concerning an assault on a Vietnamese village by Marines in 1967. The Marines tell it their way. The villagers, who presumably are living very happily under communism today, tell it their way. One Marine says, hey, we couldn't take it. I can't account for every Marine that was there. And what they done it because they felt that's what they had to do. A villager remembers, looking back at that time, I have to say that it was so horrible that I can't describe it at all. The narrative flip-flops between these two viewpoints like a fast-moving tennis match. One moment, the viewer's sympathy is all with the Marines, and the next is with the villagers. And one is left drained, angry, and confused at the end of this sequence. Of 130 Army personnel accused of war crimes as of May 21, 1971, a total of 60 had been tried by courts-martial and 29 convicted. From March 1965 to August 1971, out of a total of 136 Marines accused of crimes against Vietnamese, 90 were convicted. Granted, war crimes probably took place in Vietnam that were never discovered or reported. But war crimes cover a large variety of deeds, from mutilating the corpse of a dead enemy soldier to murdering civilians. When these allegations are made, they should be very seriously considered. This film clouds the issue. And I was left with a subtle impression that as far as the producers were concerned, the killing of non-combatant civilians was a fairly common result of heavy military action in Vietnam, when conducted by our side, that is. But from 1969 to 1972, an estimated 20,000 Vietnamese were murdered by the communists. No one has ever been brought to trial for any of those crimes. My personal experience with the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command from 1972 to 1975 reveals that as late as 1973, the U.S. Army was still very assiduously investigating allegations of war crimes charged against U.S. servicemen in Vietnam. Again, most of the heavy combat in Vietnam did not involve the assault of villages, and to suggest, as this film does, that the indiscriminate killing of non-combatants was an integral part of combat operations in Vietnam is totally false and constitutes a reprehensible slur upon the characters and the service of the hundreds of thousands of Americans who served bravely and honorably in Vietnam. And now we come to the question of what do these people think of themselves, these soldiers who fought there. The overriding impression a viewer receives from these films, especially America Takes Charge and Legacies, is that America's young soldiers were betrayed and used by our government as pawns in an unjust war and are disillusioned now with our institutions because of that experience and are, in fact, haunted by the experience, to quote the narrator. But in the face of the facts, these are totally untrue and grossly irresponsible statements. In America Takes Charge, one soldier says, "I think after a while I began to feel that someone was taking advantage of our bravery and our courage. To no good end, we were being used for God knows what purpose." Another comments, "I began increasingly to have the feeling that I was a redcoat." Now, that's a loaded word if ever there was one. And he admits that he came very close to deserting because of this feeling of alienation. The same man also tells us about his long-term feelings of guilt because he shot an old woman running in a rice field. No matter what this says about the filmmakers as decent and respectable human beings, it shows their ingenious way of capitalizing on another's turmoil as they use it to manipulate the audience into sharing the man's guilt and hopefully transferring that guilt to our whole consideration of the Vietnam War. And then the narrator in Legacies at one point informs us that of 2.5 million who served in Southeast Asia, a substantial number, some estimate 750,000, are still haunted by the experience. But according to a Lou Harris survey of Vietnam veterans commissioned by the Veterans Administration and published in 1980, 66% of the men polled rejected the notion of guilt entirely, while only 14% responded that they believed it is shameful what my country did to the Vietnamese people. And Newsweek reported in March 1981 that over 80% of Vietnam veterans had successfully made the transition to civilian life, where they are now leading normal lives. Also in Legacies, we have this statement by Arthur Eggendorf, a veteran and a psychologist. "There's a lot of people who were burned during the war years and so have retreated into a kind of cynicism or a kind of mistrust of the major institutions of our society." But the Harris survey confirmed that 66% of the veterans questioned said they would serve their country again if called on. And 91% of theater veterans, and that includes 90% of those who saw heavy combat, said they are proud to have served their country. There cannot be more profound disagreement on this subject than we have seen here. And the fact that the producers of these films have chosen to ignore the opinions of the majority of Vietnam veterans in this particular regard is not only a shocking violation of responsibility, it leads one to speculate if they have a secret agenda. That the image of the American soldier was tarnished in Vietnam is a fact. But it was not tarnished by the acts of a few individuals running amok on the battlefield or shooting up heroin in the base camps and cities of South Vietnam. The vast majority of those who served our country in Vietnam conducted themselves bravely and honorably in a cause most perceived to have been just. Today, just as the American public opinion is beginning to divest itself of the misperceptions of the Vietnam veteran, along comes the public broadcasting system with this series to warm up and serve to us all over again the half-cooked and indigestible falsehood that the American soldier misconducted himself on the battlefield in Vietnam. A person with tendencies towards paranoia might think this is all part of a plan. I say, if guilt must be assigned for anything that happened in Vietnam, then let it fall on those who made this film, all of them non-veterans, and some of them actually longtime opponents of the United States in Vietnam. I have to ask this question. Are they unconsciously or otherwise expunging their own share of the guilt for what went wrong in Vietnam by trying to transfer the responsibility to the men who fought the war? This is a heavy charge, and it should be made not lightly. But if it's true, and I think to some extent it is, it constitutes the ultimate act of cowardice of the Vietnam War. I know many men, and some here today know many others, who still endure the agony and the terrible physical and mental wounds they suffered for their country in Vietnam. And there are many, many others, plain dog-faced soldiers and jarhead Marines, who by simply keeping faith with their comrades and by doing their duty in that war have or should have earned the respect of all Americans. Each one of them is as exceptional in his own way as those who speak for him in these films. But that their heroism is neither justified nor honored here, but instead made to look like the desperate acts of imperial legionaries fighting an unjust war. That is the ultimate betrayal of the American fighting man. Thank you very much.
Al, are you ready to go?
I think what we'll do is, because try to make up for time, we'll skip the question period, if it's all right with you, Dan, and proceed. But if you'll stick around, maybe we can do some questions,
sure,
be around available. Okay, Al, how about you?
I need Dan for the interview
now. Oh, you need Dan for the interview. Okay, Dan, come back and see us, so we'll maybe get a chance to do some questions. Yeah. How about the...
Cassie?
Can everybody come up? Again, Al, we're, in order to save time, we are relying on people to read the bios and the programs. Our speakers are Al Santoli. Al has been an active questioner. You've all heard him ask questions up till now. And Si-Chan Siv. Is that Si-Chan? Oh, you're Kasey. That's Kasey Nu. How about Si-Chan? Is he here?
Yeah, Si-Chan.
Well, okay, we'll start. Well, let's start, and you can join us. Is that Si-Chan, is that male or female?
Male.
Male, okay. He will have him join us when he comes in. Okay, Al Salton, Al Santoli.
I think for this particular section on legacies, we've chosen to focus on Cambodia for a particular reason. And that, I think, plays into one of the primary shortcomings of the series, which is their lack of questioning with material available, why they would choose to go to Phnom Penh and to Hanoi to ask party functionaries and villagers under the control of people that would imprison them and their families if they didn't tell them the party line, as opposed to going to the areas which, for instance, what I'll be doing very shortly is showing you some slides of the Thai-Cambodian border and some areas inside of Western Cambodia where right now where they made a statement in the legacy section, which I think I'd like to all three of us, for Cassie, who now is the head of the Association of Cambodian Survivors, who suffered both under the Khmer Rouge and later the Vietnamese communist. And one has to separate, even though there's been historical turmoil between all the Indo-Chinese countries. Cambodia has been fighting with Thailand, Vietnam, Laos for the past 1,000 years. But at this stage of the game, the primary obstacle to peace in the region has been the obstinacy of the Hanoi Communist Party under supervision of their Soviet benefactors. And I say all of this for a reason. The PBS series says, in Legacies, the Cambodian communists, the Khmer Rouge, had seized power in a shattered society. Led by Pol Pot, they drove the population to vast agricultural collectives. Fearing communist China, communist Vietnam invaded Cambodia. The Vietnamese intervened to unseat Pol Pot, and they also put an end to the Holocaust. Okay. Then, as the series is about to end, the last 3 minutes of this entire 13-part series, they interview a Vietnam veteran after going through a series of vignettes about Central America, ridiculing President Reagan for seeing Soviet involvement and Cuban involvement in Salvador and Nicaragua. They go to an American veteran who had gone to Hanoi and then later to Phnom Penh and saying, I was part of the first delegation of Vietnam veterans to go back to Vietnam. To go back to a place where you have fought a war is a profound experience. I like to think about Vietnam as being frozen in time. I served there during the war. When people think about Vietnam, they think about it in terms of a country at war with explosions, with killing, with pain, with suffering, a lot of anguish. to go back and replace a few with those images with a new look at Vietnam, to see Vietnam as the country, to smell it, to see the rice paddies and the tree lines and the people. What I came out of this trip to Vietnam was an understanding. The most significant thing, I believe, is that we should do is make peace with Vietnam and end the war. Now, July 17th, 1984, nearly 2 weeks ago, the Communist Party of Vietnam awarded Andrei Gromyko, the Soviet leader, the Order of Ho Chi Minh. And the decoration says, this comes right out of the Hanoi official media radio broadcast. The decoration says that the State Council of the Communist Party is presenting Andrei Gromyko for his outstanding contribution to strengthening the development of great friendship, militant solidarity, and all-around cooperation between Vietnam and the Soviet Union on the occasion of Gromyko's birthday. This is the same award, which is the highest award of the Vietnamese Communist Party, that they gave to Leonid Brezhnev a couple of years ago. And before that, they gave it to their Chemical Warfare Division for their work after the liberation of the country and their chemical warfare attacks in Laos and Cambodia, and also the ones they used on the Chinese in 79, which our media has tended to either ridicule in large part or try to ignore. What I've done in my trips to the Cambodian border is take a lot of slides. I've been one of the few Westerners that somehow, by hook and by crook, had the ties allowed into the areas when the refugee camps were being attacked. I've talked to a lot of Cambodians and Vietnamese and Lao and Hill Tribe people about the suffering going on in their countries. I would like to read statements before I show slides by a representative of each of the ethnic groups. The first is Vietnamese. This past Tet, 1984, I spent a very emotional 2 days in the CQ refugee camp in Thailand, which is basically a prison camp. Although now it's a little better because people are being resettled for the up to 10,000 Vietnamese that have been held there. It's been a very difficult experience. This was an address given to the entire community of relief workers, Thai officials, and the what I call the inmates of the refugee camp by the Vietnamese leader in the camp. He says, just as a bird has its nest, so a man must have his place. Each of us is certainly looking back to our native land where our loved ones are languishing. Following the communist takeover on the 30th of April, 1975, all our fellow countrymen have been denied basic human rights. Millions of people have been sent to barren areas known as new economic zones. Countless nationalist soldiers have been languishing in jail scattered in the four corners of our land. A sizable number of youths have been drafted and sent to the battlefields in Laos and Kampuchea to carry out the expansionist policy of the Hanoi dictatorship, a hireling of the Soviet Union. A happy, peaceful life is only a memory. Death in communist jails is now routine. Even old people are urged to do forced labor. On top of it, most Vietnamese people are now on starvation diet. The more we think of the communist crimes, the harder we find it to repress our just anger. The next, regarding the Lao, lowland Lao rather than Hmong, and the reason I've chosen the lowland Lao is because a lot of people tend to focus only on the problems that the hill tribes have had tend to use the excuse that, well, it was because they were the CIA's secret army that there's this problem between them and the Pathet Lao and the Vietnamese. But the problem has been, as the Vietnamese have continued to consolidate their occupation of Laos, it's been a drastic situation on the lowlanders as much as the hill people. Although the hill people, there has been an active military policy directed against. Here we go. This was an excerpt that was in the Thai newspaper, the Bangkok World, from June 9, 1984, and I'll read directly the excerpt. More than 1,000 Laotians have fled to this northeastern province, Nang Khai, since the beginning of this month, and more are expected to come. Provincial authorities said yesterday. Sri Chiang Mai district officer said more than 420 Laotians crossed the Mekong River into the district since June 1st. Officials are providing food and lodging for them. The refugees said that the Laotian government was preparing a new commune system under which people will be doing forced labor. Violations of the new commune system would face punishment, they said. Among the refugees were former Laotian military officers, Lieutenant Tong Singhalat, 58 years old, and Lieutenant Sampu Putong, age 57. Both of them said they fled from a government seminar, in which they were told that Vietnamese families would be moved to live in Laotian villages in order to help Laotian people in their agricultural work. Under this program, they said about 500,000 Vietnamese would be resettled in Laotian villages next year. Now, whether that 500,000 number is accurate, I don't know. I know for a fact that 500,000 number minimum is accurate for Cambodia. There is a policy of Vietnamization going on now in Cambodia by which a large number of Vietnamese farmers, fishermen, lumber people, gem miners and gem merchants are being moved into Cambodian territory, in fact, the most prosperous and the most lush Cambodian territory. When people talk about starvation in these countries, as Mr. their representative in the PBS series said, he went to Vietnam and he saw rice fields. People go into Cambodia, I'll show you pictures of rice fields where there's rice and there's water. There is no drought. There is no famine. Why are the people hungry? Well, the problem number one is that in exchange for the weapons that they get from the Soviets, the Vietnamese Communist Party has to give them something in exchange. And a lot of what they give them is the raw agricultural resources of all three Indochinese countries. So in effect, Vietnam takes from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, and it in turn goes to the Soviet Union. And as a Cambodian who interviewed Mr. Ung Chimnet, who was a railroad official until he became a refugee about 6 months ago, said that as he would watch the Soviets and East Germans send in new tanks and artillery into the southern port of Kampamsam, move them up to Phnom Penh and then to the battlefields in central and western Cambodia, and at the same time you would watch their rice, their lumber, their gold, all their precious resources being moved on to Vietnam, and then from there, of course, being moved on to the Soviet Union. And I'd say this, that one cannot blame the Vietnamese people because they're suffering and they're as hungry as the Laotians and Cambodians. The source of the problem is in Hanoi. And for PBS to go to Hanoi and ask these very officials who are creating this suffering for those people to provide them with witnesses and to give them interviews, which they will use as historical fact, I think is a real travesty. I'd like now to show some slides. Is it possible that somebody can get the lights? Oh, the black? Oh, forgive me. Okay. Is the slide projector on, Sandra? Well, I'll keep talking. Another major problem with this Vietnamese occupation and the ongoing Indochina war is that Cameron Bay is now a major Soviet military base. What people tend to not realize is that the Straits of Malacca, which is located between Indonesia and Cambodia, is a very narrow strait of water that connects the China Sea basically with the Indian Ocean and then into the Persian, the Arab and Persian Gulfs, of which Japan gets all of its oil, of which 80% of U.S. strategic materials pass. It used to take, when the Soviets only had a navy in Vladivostok, 2 weeks to get to the Straits. Now, from Cameron Bay, it takes 2 days. Their fleet has, I have the exact number. The Soviet Pacific Fleet has expanded since 1975. They didn't have in 75 more than 60 vessels. Now it's more than 720, which poses a big problem for our navy. And with instability in the Philippines right now, by which, and also in New Zealand, where our Navy might be moved back as far as another maybe 1,000 miles to Guam, it gives the Soviets all that much more power and control in the region, which could make, eventually, Thailand, Japan, and others bend to their will. And in the case of a war, we would be in very deep trouble. And that's why the Sobs, you know, find Vietnam such an important place to be. Okay, I'll go back one. These were taken in the spring of 1983 in a place called near Phnom Chat, Cambodia, and in an area around Oranya Pratet, Thailand. This is a group of about 20,000 refugees that were under Vietnamese artillery and tank assault. Majority were women and kids. every year, the opposition to Vietnamese rule in Cambodia has been growing, not only in the form of active resistance militarily, but in the form of peasants fleeing. Right now on the Thai border, there's about 250,000 Cambodians. The refugee camps of Nong Samet, the refugee camp of Ampil inside Cambodia, and the camp of Kawidong in Thailand are among the five largest cities in Cambodia, populated all by refugees, or in the case of the camps inside of Cambodia, the UN does not consider them refugees, they're considered displaced people. These pictures were taken at about noon. These people had been under attack since 4 in the morning. The Vietnamese hit them while they all were sleeping. In the case of attacking places like Phnom Chat, which are basically grass thatch settlements, they use white phosphorus artillery among high explosives to make sure it burns quickly. It's a mess. And you'll find in this case, this was before the relief groups put pressure on the Thai, that the Thai waited a good couple hours before they let them come over the border to safety, and they were getting creamed for having to stay right on the border. I joined them about 3 kilometers inside of Thailand, which this was taken, and the artillery, Vietnamese were walking the artillery right with them. As you can see, a lot of mothers with babies, there were women trying to give us their kids, any Westerner they saw, relief worker or otherwise, trying to get their kids some kind of safety. There were a lot of old people that were dying of heart attacks and heat stroke. At the hospital at Kawidong, they had to set up a triage system where I forget the exact number, but there were a couple score people who died of bleeding to death. They ran out of plasma. Again, heat, 100 degree heat, dust, no water. They reached a clearing about 5 kilometers inside of Thailand. And again, this past year, the refugee camps of Ampil, 30,000 people. The refugee camp of Tatum, another 30,000 people. And a couple of smaller refugee camps were attacked, which brought about 100,000 Cambodians fleeing into Thailand, into little areas like this. As you can see here in the background, the line of people stretched out for a good mile and a half to 2 miles of people barely hanging in there. Red Cross administering aid. And the main victims of this are the kids. I think you'll find in all the refugee camps, the population is at least 1/3 children under 12 years old. Again, it says two things. Number one is that there's hope. People still keep having kids, that they're gonna make it. The Cambodians especially have been under such horrible experiences in 75 that you would think that, you know, a weaker group of people would be exterminated or they would have given up. But you find the Cambodians hanging in there, which is a sign of hope. This is the infamous tank ditch that in many parts of the Thai and Cambodian border separates, you know, the rival factions of Vietnamese and Thai army when they face off against each other. This is also the place where the refugees are either held up or allowed into for some kind of safety. And unfortunately, there's been many times when they've been held there and have suffered the worst of it. Now, this is the refugee camp at Nong Samet, which houses about 60,000 people. As you can see, this is a typical Cambodian displaced people community. All of the huts primarily are grass thatch. Some blue plastic. You always find the UN and border relief people hanging out blue plastic, which it does serve a function. During the monsoon, it does keep the rain off of people. But basically, it shows how vulnerable they also are to the phosphorus and artillery, since they burn very quickly. A lot of people come to the border with nothing, as this old man, and they start from scratch with their plastic and their bamboo poles, trying to put some kind of a life together. It speaks for itself. And again, I'm one of the Cambodian families in the camp. This is a mother who twice a day usually the UN will come in with food, rice, usually just rice, and some water. People have a water ration. Out there, there's very little water, so the water has to be trucked in. During the dry season, during the rainy season, there's too much. It's all mud. But during the dry season, for about 4 or 5 months out of the year, it's very dry. And again, this is a family. This is when the Vietnamese had attacked Nong Chan refugee camp, and all the people had to flee north toward Nong Samet. And every year this happens, same. The people set up their blue plastic and they try to survive for another year, and the next season they're attacked again and they try to survive again. So if you figure the population of Cambodia right now is about 6 million, and there's about 250,000 people on the border, and from what I heard today from somebody who talked with relief people on the border, that about 18,000 new people have arrived since May. This is where they're living, this is the way they're living right now. But you always find the smiling faces. You find there is hope. And this is the schoolyard. In Nong Samet, there's what the Cambodians have been trying to do since, you know, the Khmer Rouge eliminated all school teachers. Since they've been on the border in these camps in 79, they've been trying to reestablish Buddhist religion and also school. But because not only are there no school teachers, but there's no educational materials, it's been a seat-of-the-pants kind of operation. But, you know, for elementary level, they've been putting a lot of kids in to try to get basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. This is the camp at Ampil. Half of it was burned down about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. As you can see, it's the same, the grass thatch. People try to have gardens. The UN will only give them rice primarily, so they have to try to grow their own vegetables and whatnot to get the proper kinds of vitamins. There is malnutrition, although I think maybe in some of these camps malnutrition is less than it is inside the country, where the Vietnamese have a policy of starvation to try to subjugate the people. I'll just run through these without speaking. This time last year, the new arrivals. There were about 26,000 new people that came in from the central and western provinces because of the stepped up Vietnamese oppression. What they were doing is moving the Cambodians around the Great Lake, which is abundant with fish, and the primary fertile rice farming areas into less bountiful areas, or putting them into forced labor and moving in Vietnamese farmers and fishermen to take over that land. So these are some of the new arrivals, again, came to the border with nothing but the clothes on their back. And again, a major source of the problem is those are brand new Soviet recoilless rifle rounds. In fact, I took one into Bangkok with me to show the U.S. military attaché, since our wonderful intelligence people had nobody out on the border to monitor this stuff. And we had to hide it from the Thai border guards, and we actually sat on it inside of our station wagon. But it was brand new Soviet stuff that the Vietnamese had just received that they were using against the refugee camps. And these are defectors from the puppet regime, the Hinh Samrin regime, who I should mention are former Khmer Rouge. The leadership of the Vietnamese puppet government now, although they make these brazen statements about the horrors of the Pol Pot Yang Suri clique, were themselves generals who in the field actually oversaw the slaughter of 2 million or 1.2 million, whatever it was, people under Pol Pot Yang Suri. So there's really no difference between the Vietnamese and Pol Pot, except the Viet Sur and the way they're going about it is a bit more subtle. But the Holocaust does continue. And this is a gas mask that the Thais captured off the Vietnamese, as well as other chemical equipment and chemical antidotes, with Vietnamese writing explaining how to use them during chemical attacks. And I should mention that most Vietnamese infantry soldiers do carry gas masks. And these are some hated Khmer Rouge. I went into their area for one reason, it's because they were getting hit with gas. And sure enough, the reports proved to be true. Also, the gas was blowing over into Thailand. And if anybody bothered to check the record at the Phang Nam Run District Hospital, they would have found a large number of Thai villagers hit with the gas, excuse me, and showing the same kinds of physical symptoms as the Hmong and the Cambodians and even Afghanis had talked about for years. But our journalists, those stationed inside Thailand, never bothered to do that. And this is one of the Thai villagers that was hit by the gas going into an area with the Thai Marines where the attacks have been taking place. And this is rice. This is what it's all about. This is what the wars are about. And for somebody to say that, you know, the reason that people are starving in those countries is because there's no food, it's baloney. The reason is the food's going to the wrong place. And I think, I don't want to talk too much longer. I'm sorry to rush through this. But I think that Kasi and Sichan, being Cambodia, could express things much more eloquently than I can. So, thank you.